Brad Parmery from Public Restaurant. Welcome to StirThePot.org.
Thanks.
Who are your major influences and how did you start cooking?
I started cooking when I was going for an engineering degree at Penn State. I'd been cooking a lot to make money to get through school and found out that that's where my real passion lies, not with engineering but with cooking. So I decided to take a year off. And of all places, I wanted to go to London and just see what they were doing over there with their food scene. And I met Peter Gordon and very early on, and he ended up being a huge influence on me.
And on your website, you talked about how you were really influenced by your mom in terms of home cooking and stuff. Tell us a little bit about something with your mom, because a lot of chefs talk about their mom being their big influence, and sometimes I go, gosh, you know, I think they're just using it as a byline to say, my mom showed me everything.
Yeah, I think my mom, especially in the 70s, she was quite a maverick, you know. In the days of Wonder Bread, we were having homemade pita bread, and she would bake bread every day. She's had a garden as long as I can remember, and it's great. It taught me the seasonality of food. When asparagus season hit, you know, we had it every meal, which, again, at the time, you don't really appreciate it as much as you do now. But she was always cooking a lot of ethnic food. She probably has Gourmet in Bon Appetit magazine going back to their beginning. She was a great influence just on always trying to do new recipes and trying to show us new foods.
Do you think cooking is an art or a trade?
A bit of both. I think that, you know, at its base, it's a trade. You know, you are trying to keep people happy. You're trying to give people what they want. But I think, fortunately, when you're the head chef, it moves more into an art. And you can, I guess, be slightly more philosophical about it. And it's not all about sales. It's not all about just getting bums on seats. It can be more about trying to kind of teach people your philosophy about food. And I guess it all depends on how far you want to take it. I think if it's a French bistro and you want to give people proper French food, it's more of a trade. But if you want to try to create something new, I think that's where it becomes more of an art.
And how do you prepare a dish? What's your creative process?
A lot of the creative process is I'll look at most of it comes from traveling. And so if I'm traveling, I'll eat a dish, and that usually starts the juices flowing. You know, I'll take that dish and think, you know, where's the richness coming from? Where's the acidity? What's their presentation like? And I'll just start vibing off that a little bit and seeing where it gets me.
And what should, like, the world know about your kitchen, what you're doing today at Public?
Oh, wow. Fortunately, I'm not in the kitchen yet today, but I think that, you know, we're trying to have a lot of fun with food, and we're trying to use interesting ingredients, but at the same time trying to keep it at a great price point so that people can afford to come in here and try something they've never tried before. A lot of what I like is when people come with a preconceived notion, like, oh, I don't like tongue, ox tongue, or veal tongue, or lamb's tongue. And, you know, I just think they haven't had it done properly, and so I'd like to kind of clear up the record on anchovies and tongues and oxtails and things like that, or sweetbreads, where I just feel that people haven't had them correctly prepared.
My wife didn't have the anchovies, or I think it was the sardines actually last time, and she missed out, so we enjoyed it. And I still want to find out how you made those little croquettes, but I have my idea. I just, you know, I disseminated in my mind. I said, it's kind of like a falafel. So I said, there's got to be something in there.
Yep.
What are your latest ventures? Are you going to do a cookbook? What are you doing?
We've talked a lot about doing a cookbook. The only problem that we've run into is so many publishers want, you know, a new and different idea. No one wants to publish a restaurant cookbook anymore. They need you to have an angle, you know, quick and easy, 30 minutes, you know, blindfolded cooking, you know, whatever it may be, sword swallowing. Everyone needs an angle, whereas, you know, we don't want to push our food into a preconceived notion or a formula. We just want to present it very naturally in the way it is. We have started talking about doing a second restaurant, and we've looked at property, and we're going down that road, and fingers crossed maybe something will happen this year.
That's interesting, because I notice a lot of people, you know, having a lot of restaurants, Sometimes I kind of wonder, geez, is the chef there? And that's kind of been a big subject in the papers. What do you think about, like, empire building and chefs outgrowing what they started as?
Yeah, I think as long as people see it as, you know, the chef's idea and not the chef's cooking, you know, I don't have a problem with that. The funny thing is, just for that reason, we've been looking in the neighborhood for property, because we want to keep it the same feel. And everything we do here is very hands-on. And even if it was in Brooklyn or uptown, I don't think that we could get the right feel to it. So we want to keep it so that, you know, it's a very short distance away.
I worked at the Sony Club, and I kind of, we had a kind of very open kitchen where we did, you know, we had a sushi bar, we did pizza, and we try to not be too classical, but we borrowed a lot of ideas from, you know, classical things or unclassical things, and just tried really weird variants. You guys are doing what I read was called free-spirited fusion. What is free-spirited fusion?
The funny thing is, you know, moving back to America, everyone said you can't use the word fusion. Everyone's going to stick you up on a cross, you know, and persecute you. So we've kept the word out of it, but now, you know, we're just trying to be very real about what we're doing. I see it as, you know, not taking food so, so seriously. There's not yelling going on in the kitchen. It's a fun, creative atmosphere, and where you can really have fun with food, and you're borrowing ideas from around the world. I've done a lot of traveling over the last 10 years, and I'm not ashamed to admit, you know, that you get influenced a little bit from Japan or Vietnam or Cambodia or Australia, and, you know, you pick up on these little bits and pieces and put them into your own cooking. You know, I think there's a place for traditional French food, there's a place for traditional Italian food, but I also feel there's a great place for fusion food and, you know, introducing people to these interesting ingredients that they probably aren't familiar with.
And you bake your bread here too at
yes,
Publix?
Yes, we do. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And is that because of your love of that home-spirited cuisine that your mom did? Or?
A lot of it is. I've been baking bread for about 6 or 7 years, and I love it. Plus, I think every aspect of the restaurant should showcase what the chef wants to show you. If you want, you know, I think if you get store-bought bread, it's almost like if you buy an ice cream, you know. Those are shortcuts that if you don't have the time, it's fine to take them, but we have the time, and it's something that I love as well. As you well know, baking bread's very therapeutic, so gets
very
my...
Much.
Can get some of my angst and anger out as well.
You shouldn't beat the bread. It's not nice.
What did that bread ever do to you?
Yeah. Well, you said food was sort of intellectualized. What about food TV and TV chefs? Do you think there's really a place for it, or has it gone, like, really way out of bounds and really kind of stupid?
I think it's gone pretty far, and I'm sure that's going to curve right back, you know? Just like any entertainment source, you know, it will, reality TV or cartoons or anything, it's going to come full circle and come back. And I think that, you know, there's only so much interest people are going to have about watching food TV. Now so much of it just seems so forced, as opposed to just show. Again, everyone needs a new angle, a new look on the food TV show, which, you know, some of it's just forced into a mold. But you know, I like some of it. I don't get time to watch it, but I'm sure that some of it's very good. But again, I think it will get pared back and scaled back in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I just actually saw one of my heroes of food television. It was Mike Colomico.
Oh, yeah.
From the PBS show. And it was really funny because I had made a cheesecake recipe that he had on his website, and I was reading a book at Pain Quotidien, and I turned around and he was there. I said, "Oh, Mike Colomico," and he like looked at me like, "Uh oh, who's this nut job?" So
stalker.
Yeah, get away from me. What do you think about the Michelin coming to New York? And in general, what do you think about critics like the New York Times or the Post or the Daily News and such?
I think those are two fairly different subjects, but I'll hit the Michelin guide first. I think hit's a proper term to use. I was a bit disappointed to see that they were coming to America. The Michelin Guide's been losing a lot of popularity within Europe over the last couple of years. And the funny thing happened in London, or I should say in England, in the UK. Out of nowhere, they started giving stars to restaurants that kind of didn't want them, and they weren't even fitting into what the whole Michelin system was. And so it became a little bit unusual, and everyone's wondering why they did that. And it kind of came out that, you know, the guide's losing popularity. The more restaurants that are involved, the more that those restaurants will say, hey, this is a great guide. And so when I heard that they were coming to New York, it kind of smelled a bit fishy to me, if you know what I mean. And also, if you look at who got stars and who didn't, you know, some of it seems like a random roll of the dice, or you almost wonder if they even went to certain restaurants. So it's not a big deal. For both myself and the guests that we have here, I don't think that's the crowd that are reading the Michelin Guide or even care about it. But of course, it makes interesting news and interesting fodder for over the table.
Well, I had worked at a restaurant years ago, and a certain guide that everybody knows, it's in a little kind of a colored book.
Yeah.
The gentleman walked in and was actually the guy who was the publisher of that certain guide. And he came up to the owner of the restaurant, and our owner was really like mortified, and, oh my God, sit down, have dinner with us. He goes, no, I'm going somewhere else. And he had a few drinks, I think. His limo was parked out front. He goes, duh. Don't worry, we'll get you in the guide this year. Don't forget to send the check. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. So that's kind of my my side of the story of those things. And I mean, I've seen, like, the New York Times, for me, I'm a really harsh critic on everything in food because I work in the business, right. And I kind of feel like there's really bad writing. I mean, it's like writers who are not people who cook or understand cooking.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, especially Michelin, with the whole thing in England, there's like Marco Pierre White and the guy that you work for, Nico, who were having problems with Michelin. What do you think about that big controversy?
Yeah, it was funny because also, you know, back when I first moved to England in 94, 95, 96, you know, these restaurants with three Michelin stars would go out of business because you couldn't make money that way. We would have 15 people in the kitchen, and for lunch you would do probably 24 or 25 covers, you know. You can't make money that way, and they were forcing themselves to overproduce food, and it just, you know, again, it was a little bit just forced, and eventually restaurants started going away from the Michelin system because, you know, you can't turn a profit, and it was so stuffy, and it just didn't feel right, you know. Food over there was moving towards a more modern approach, and again, more fun and interesting things, and you couldn't get Michelin stars that way back when I first got there. But also with the whole guides and the rating system, it is tough. And when we first opened here, I, you know, even when we got a good review, I'd die a thousand deaths, you know, because they'd say one bad thing about one dish, and you know, you feel slightly heartbroken. It's like a personal attack. And fortunately, you know, I think we cater to a different audience than a lot of New York City does, and we're lucky that we have a great loyal following. And so, you know, people either get our food or they don't, and they write about it in both ways. You know, within 1 week, someone can say they had the most amazing meal ever here, and at the same time, you know, 2 days later, we'll get a slanderous review where they couldn't understand why you would pair these two flavors together. So I guess after 2.5 years, we've weathered the initial storm, and you know, we're still full, so we're very lucky.
And who's your hardest critic?
Myself.
Mine is my wife.
Yeah, my fiance is a pretty tough critic. She's also worked in the restaurant industry for a long time, and she tells it how it is, you know, which is good, because I'd rather hear it from her than 200 people that come in the door every night.
Do you find yourself being a critic when you go to other restaurants, and or do you try to stay a little bit outside of that experience?
I usually stay outside of it, but you know, the only time I get critical is when I go into a restaurant, I expect a good version of that food. If you go into a diner, you want a great piece of meatloaf, you know. If you go into a Danielle, you want a beautiful French meal, you know. It's, I think as long as it's staying true to what they represent and what they sort of tell you they are, that's fine, you know. If I want chips and salsa, yeah, hook me up, you know. Just make sure that there's some salt on this, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'm very critical, and I'm also pretty happy that someone else is putting the food on the table for one night.
And what do you think about New York in terms of restaurants now? Do you see a trend in restaurants, or is there something new that's making New York, I don't know, the mecca of the world, or is it the opposite? Is England like the new place? Because I find for myself that a lot of the English guys are more open to talking about stuff, mm-hmm. and there's just a different, I mean, I guess England's got such a bad reputation as food, but
yeah.
I've been there a few times and I really like a lot of the stuff that I've seen there.
Yeah.
Find it a lot more open.
Yeah, I think there is a good conversation going on with the chefs over there, and people are being open, but I think I'm lucky. I've found the same thing in New York. People were great about giving me advice when I first got here, and I actually found the chef community for people my age, and chefs who have just started opening their own places. It seems like everyone's really great, and that they are very happy to give you information, very happy to help you out and support each other. So I've found it to be pretty good over here. I definitely think that New York is one of the meccas of the food world. Again, I've done a good bit of traveling, and I am amazed at how many amazing restaurants are happening in New York. It's incredible.
Even though it costs like $7 million to open one.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you think it's hard to make friends in the business when you're competing with them?
Yeah, I do think so, but at the same time, I think it's easy to find a point of difference. You know, we're not formal, we're not casual, so I think a lot of the more formal restaurants don't see us as competition. We're doing some very different cuisine than most other people are doing, so again, I'm not competing with a great French restaurant or a 2-Michelin-star restaurant or a great Italian restaurant that we have right down the street here. It was a good example. The chef, Frankie, from Peasant, who's only like 4 doors down, when we opened our doors, he wasn't angry or upset. You know, he came down, welcomed us to the neighborhood, thought, you know, we're just building this into a great food neighborhood instead of, oh, you're going to take my clientele. You know? So I think as long as you're doing something different, it's easy to see a point of difference between people.
Yeah, and I live in Queens, and I find it hard to find a really good restaurant, you know? I mean, I'm sure there's a few good ones. Mm-hmm. I've been to a few things that are so-so. But it's hard for, like, I mean, I guess Brooklyn is another place where there's a lot of really cool things happening.
Yeah.
But there's some neighborhoods it just doesn't pick up. And
right.
I mean, I kind of wonder why. Why isn't New York eating and, you know, why isn't it, like, equal rights for all eaters?
All boroughs.
Yeah.
Can we get a spread to all boroughs, please? Yeah, I wonder if it's also because probably to Brooklyn as well, initially people probably moved there to spend less, and so maybe that market didn't happen, but whenever people realized how close it is to Manhattan and people were commuting, you know, they were willing to spend money in their own neighborhood. Maybe it will happen in Queens as well. I'm not super familiar with it up there, although my chefs say the same thing as you. You know, they say that there's not a whole lot happening on like a mid-level scale.
Right. And New York is like concrete and lots of pollution and lots of traffic now. How do you inspire yourself in a community like that? I mean, there's really great markets and things. But, you know, I've talked to chefs about how food comes from all over the world. There's no real seasonality in the city. Right. So how do you make it seasonal? I mean, you have food coming from overseas,
yeah.
Which is not a bad thing. Yeah. I mean, I was like, wow, Tasmanian fish. I was like, that's great.
Yeah, I think we're lucky that we have traveled a lot to see the farms and talk to the people in Australia, in New Zealand, a little bit in the UK, in Morocco, you know, to see the source of our ingredients. And there is basically still seasonality within their one product. So it doesn't necessarily match up to our seasonality, but you still know that you can only get this fish for about 6 months, and you know that the oysters in the southern hemisphere are going to be great maybe when our oysters aren't so great. So you're still following a cycle, it's just not necessarily what everyone has understood growing up. Like you can get berries in December, but they're not going to be great. But especially with the fish, that ends up being very seasonal with us.
Yeah, because I find myself being kind of a snob, I just want to get local fish. I don't want to go out of my my territory.
Yeah.
One thing, I think my clients are just used to not eating. I mean, I've tried barramundi before and other fish, and they won't go for it.
Yeah.
But now I've, you know, started going, hey, let's go with cod. But they're all like, oh, I had that when I was in my private school when I was a kid. But actually now they're starting to like it. They're going, wow, cod's really good. It was delicious.
Yeah.
Do you develop your menus on a personal level, or is it you just pick and choose, or do you share with your kitchen staff on ideas? Or?
My sous chefs are great. I've known my my one sous chef for about 10 years now, and he also cooked with Peter Gordon in London. He's one of the first guys I met in London, actually, and you know, we knew each other for about 4 or 5 years. We were very close friends in London. Then he moved over here, worked for some chefs, but it's great to bounce ideas back and forth off of him. And dishes like the anchovy dish, you know, we both put bits and pieces into it to create one dish. And, you know, he'll say, well, what about pickled mango? And I'll say, no, what about pickled onions? And, you know, we just bounce back and forth and create something better than just one of us could have done. Most of the menu, I do come up with the concepts myself, but it's great if people want to feed into it. And also that helps them be creative and be artistic, and, you know, hopefully they want to continue in this restaurant in that fashion.
And do you sometimes, like, create a dish and you sit down and really think it out, or do you just, like, it comes out and wow?
Well, a bit of both. You know, I've thought out, you know, how I'm flipping around a traditional dish, like even the anchovy dish, you know, we were basing it on, you know, South American dishes, but also I wanted to base it on pickled mackerel and, you know, roll mops and things like that. So, you know, you are thinking down a few different lines and you come out with one dish. So,
what's really exciting in the food industry for you now?
I'll tell you what's not exciting first.
Uh-huh.
The one thing that I'm a little bit bored about, and I hope that this sort of slowly comes to an end, is a lot of the kind of chemical cooking that's going on. You know, there's very few people that do it well. You know, I ate at Heston Blumenthal's restaurant in England, and they do it very well there. I think that that's a great example. I've never eaten at El Bulli. I'm sure that they do it very well. But it seems like the very wells are few and far between, and there's a lot of people doing it very badly. And you end up with food that's more interesting, less edible. And that I hope that trend's coming to an end. I don't see that as being very natural for food. Again, it's more of something to think. It would be better in a book, something to think about instead of put in my mouth. I think that obviously organic is huge. You know, that's come down to a consumer level, and that's great. You know, it's great that that's available and almost everyone can get their hands on some. For myself, I think that, you know, a lot of the seafood from down in Australia and New Zealand, that's very exciting. It's just starting to be imported the last couple of years. It's very crystal clear, beautiful water. And there, fortunately, both Australia and New Zealand have learned from people's past mistakes. You know, they're not polluting their systems. They're making it both economical and feasible and biodynamic. And, you know, they want to do things that are not only good for the consumer, the salesperson, but for the environment as well. So I think that that's a great trend, you know. And I think that that shows in a lot of the wine as well, you know, just trying to keep it natural and clean.
Yeah, I had a really good one here, the Airstrip.
Oh, that's one of my favorite.
That was fantastic. It was, your waitress was really wonderful. She was very good at service, and she was, like, right on the point with that wine. It was like drinking butterscotch. It didn't have, like, an acidy, like, Chardonnay kind of thing, but it was, like, wow, it was very neutral, but really buttery. I like that a lot.
I love wines like that as well. I think they go great with our food, very clean wines, you know. A lot of times, you know, with a lot of French wines, people want the wine to overpower the food. And of course, the chef will tell you the opposite, that the food's got to overpower the wine slightly. But here, I think we have the happy hand-in-hand relationship with food and wine where, you know, they're very clean flavors, you know, and can still be complex, but very clean. And they go good with the spices and flavors that we use in the food.
Well, one thing that really I noticed, too, was there are a lot of Asians coming to your restaurants, too. And I said, wow, that's interesting. I mean, it's kind of like, what's so interesting about that? But I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I don't know how, but just recently we've had a ton of press in Japan and Hong Kong as well. And that quite quickly translated into a lot of Asian guests.
That's cool.
Yeah.
How do you disseminate your ideas about cooking to young chefs? And how do you try to get them from being just average cooks to really great chefs?
We're fortunate. We have a lot of young chefs that come to us that want to learn how to cook. We do a lot of demonstrations at the French Culinary Institute and the ICE, and right after that, we usually get a line at the door of people who want to come and see what we're doing, because it is a little bit different from what chefs are doing. And we've built up a great system. A lot of it is talking to them about taste, about what's actually happening in your mouth when you're eating this food and how to balance that. You know, in talking about balance, I think, you know, people can learn recipes, but the hard thing is learning what food should taste like in your mouth and how it should be balanced with the acid, the richness, even a touch of bitterness, which is ignored in most American restaurants. Whereas in India and Asia, bitterness is a vital component to most food. And so just kind of trying to show them how you build up flavors. First you want to build richness, and then what acidity is going to cut that richness, leaving you with a clean, fresh taste in your mouth. And so after that, then they can start talking about recipes, and then they can start talking about food and their ideas and how they're going to follow that and build up a proper flavor components.
So that's what's really cool, is finding ingredients and then saying, how do I use this, and then incorporating what I do. I mean, I'm using soybeans at work, and I never thought these guys would ever eat stuff like that, and they do. They like crunchy sprouts. I'm like, wow, it's a health salad, you know?
Yeah, it's great to, again, I think once people start incorporating things, and, you know, or maybe I can use soybeans instead of green beans or peas. And, you know,
lima beans.
Yeah, it becomes a very natural process, whereas people think of fusion as a forced thing, but it's not. You know, if you're just incorporating things that are doing the same, have the same role within the dish, fresh, green, crunchy, you know, why not use a different version of that?
And who are your, contemporary chefs that you really like a lot?
God, I've had amazing meals at Crew with Shea Gallant. I think that he's, for me, he's got probably some of the most exciting food in New York. I had amazing meals at Sumile with Josh Tichelis. I think he's actually left there. He's opened a new restaurant, which is unfortunate. But I think also these guys have great handles on flavors and clarity of flavor and not heavy food. You know? Yeah, I think that's some of the best that I've had.
And what's your favorite type of food, or is that really closing the door on everybody else?
Yeah, that's tough. You know, I guess it's whenever I go out for just for a bite to eat, I love Mexican food, which is hilarious because I don't cook any Mexican food. You know, and that's probably why I love it. And also I feel that it's so comforting. It's great comfort food for me. I think whenever I go out for big meals, you know, I like to see people who are doing similar things to me and, you know, see what they're doing with these ingredients. Yeah. I forgot to leave out Andrew Carmelini. I think, you know, again, I've had some amazing meals at his restaurant, and I'm looking forward to the opening of his new restaurant, so I think it's going to be great stuff.
Well, it just shows how out of focus I am with the real industry, because I'm in a club, so I hardly know these guys. Who the hell is that? You're close to Chinatown. Do you take advantage of going there and seeing things? I mean, Chinatown here, I think, is slowly dying away. It's decomposing. But I've been out to Flushing, and I went to this place called Shabu Shabu. It was, like, great. It was, like, what it meant. It was a big pot of stock, and you make your own soup, and it was, like, fantastic.
Yeah, I love that. We send our chefs down to, I should say, our cooks down to Chinatown. We've got a couple purveyors down there that don't deliver, and the nice thing is the walk down there is as inspiring as actually getting the ingredients. Mm-hmm. So we usually tell them, if you see anything fun and interesting, just buy it on the way. The same thing with Calustians. We say if there's spices you've never heard of, just buy it. You know, if it's $8-$10, we don't mind. You know, and we'll formulate a plan of how these cooks can learn to use these spices, and everyone gets to taste them. So, yeah.
It's interesting because I went to Ecuador, where my wife's from, and it was years ago, and I had to do like a speech at a couple schools for culinary schools, and of course it was trying to do my Spanish routine, and which wasn't bad, but at the end of the course, they all said, "We speak English," and I was like, "Oh, thanks, you know, here I am sweating, you know, and you guys are, like, making me talk Spanish." They said, but it was really funny. But it was funny because a lot of the kids came up to me later and said, "Oh, how do you garnish the plate? What do you garnish with? Do you use parsley or lemon?" I'm like going, God, you know, that's so ancient, and what are they teaching these poor kids?
Yeah.
But still, you see a lot of that here, too. I mean, there's such a variance in how people bring across ideas to cooks. What's your way of changing that old stale kind of thing?
Yeah, I think also our way is we try to teach people about just the natural dish, you know, not adding anything for the sake of adding it, you know. I think there's so many vibrant, beautiful colors in food and so many amazing textures that you don't need to add a superfluous thing just to get a color. You know, I think that there's so much balance already going on, and that should be part of the thought process of the chef, you know, keeping it natural and keeping it very clean. And, you know, the natural beauty, again, that goes away from some of these strange scientific processes, you know.
Guar gum.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to use meat glue, you know. The word alone scares me. But yeah, I think it, just having the simple beauty of the dish is great.
Well, we were actually going to take my mom for her birthday to another guy who's a purveyor of the guar gum and stuff. And then I couldn't get a reservation, so I said, you know what, let's go to Public. I've been there a couple times. I like it.
And yeah.
I want to see what it's all about.
That's great. I'm glad you came. That was a fun time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me.